Yesterday, there was a screening of the retrospective, and it's only one movie this time because it's a very special movie, Elektra Glide in Blue. A lot of people were there last night, and this was the first time for me that I had the opportunity to see this film on a big screen. James William Guercio, the director, is with me, and we can talk about a little bit about this screening. How did you feel after last night's screening at Casablanca Kino here at the festival?
Oh, great audience. This festival is very interesting. And I've never been to Oldenburg, but I've been through a lot of cities in Germany. Pretty much all the cities. I mean, Frankfurt, Munich, Karlsruhe, Heidelberg, Weimar, and I've never been to Oldenburg, but I've been to, you know, I've been to Bremen and Hamburg with the music, you know, with the band Chicago and the Beach Boys and a few other groups. North Germany's very nice. People are very nice.
Yesterday evening, there was another director in the room. That was Michael Whatley,
who's the director. Yeah, I saw Michael. We were talking.
He was. He's a director, of course, of the Woodstock movie. And
yes.
After the screening, he said, like, it holds up very well still. So he gave us thumbs up for that movie yesterday.
Oh, Michael did?
Yes, he did.
Well, that's great. Yeah, the film is over 50 years ago. So I remember it vividly, but it was quite a while ago. I was in my 20s, and I was 80 a few weeks ago.
Have you ever been in touch with Michael before? Have you seen his Woodstock film when he came
out? I met Michael Lang in New York right after the festival, who was involved with him. But I had never met Michael, but I knew his work. He's from Ohio originally. Very involved in the environment.
Yeah, he's lecturing about it here at the festival.
Yeah,
as well.
He works with the UN, and he lives in Wales too, and some other places. But he's very sensitive to the environment and global warming, and very important issues.
Yeah, talking about 50 years, imagine in 1973. If someone told you in the year 2025 you will fly from America to Oldenburg to show this film 50 years later, would you have believed it?
No. Well, I wanted to, I kind of felt I owed it to, he wanted me to come a couple years ago, and my oldest son tragically died of an aneurysm unexpectedly. So I promised him I would come in the future. But that's how I met Torsten and Deborah.
Yesterday at the screening, you talked about the band members from Chicago. Of course, you've managed them for a very long time. You produced a lot of their records, and they also played small roles in the movie. How did this connection with Chicago come up at the first place? How did you meet those guys?
Well, I knew them from college. I knew the horn players. Terry, the guitar player I was the closest with, who grew up near me. Bobby's from the south side. Danny's from the north side, but no, I didn't know Danny in high school, but I knew Terry. The horn guys went to DePaul, where I went to school. I think I was a year ahead of them. Walter might have been in my class, because we were in the marching band. I played cymbals. It was ROTC, so we had to play all the military songs. That's how I got to know him, because I'd do the cymbals, and he was a sax clarinet player right ahead of me. And I aggravated him pretty much. But yeah, we went to school together.
You also did the score for Elektra Glide in Blue, so you're a composer and a musician yourself. So well, I was always wondering, why did you become a producer instead of a musician yourself?
No, I was a player. I was a musician, but I was a composition major. In Alexander Cherepin was at DePaul, and he was a orchestrator with Rimsky-Korsakov, and he knew Tchaikovsky. And so I went to the school to work with him. and he was so elderly that he had a younger wife who taught the class. So I only met him a few times. So I wasn't discouraged, but that's how it was in the academy, you know, in education and college at that time. You got a famous name, but you might not get him to teach the classes, you know. He had a very nice wife, but she was not of his caliber. But I had been making records when I was 14, 15, in Chicago. I started playing very young. Yeah, it's an interesting life. What happened in high school was I auditioned and got hired for the house band on the Dick Clark tours. So I ended up backing up a lot of the acts in the 60s, like, you know, Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Del Shannon, Gene Pitney, Roy Orbison. These are just groups I backed up. On those tours, you learned a lot of music, and I could write charts. So that's why I got the job, because I would write a lot of the charts out. Except for Motown and a couple other acts, Motown, very organized, very professional, they had charts. And they had a chap, if it was a girl group, they had like the Supremes, the Velvets. They had their own charts. They had their own costumes and a costumer. Yeah, Berry Gordy, I only met a few times, but his approach to music was like he was an auto worker, and it was very much a production line. I backed up the Temps, the Four Tops, all those acts. I grew up in the city where most of the trees were in the park. And so when I got on a bus, I got to see America. And I volunteered for most of the Canadian tours because I really liked seeing North America. Kind of, you know, there's more people in California than all of Canada. And most of those tours are black tours. I might be the only white guy on the bus, but it's what exposed me to North America and why I wanted to live in the country and that kind of thing.
You could have been easily made a living, and you made a living just producing music. So how did you become a director? I know you had a love for film from a very early age on.
I wanted to use music to get the film because, you see, my grandfather on my father's side was a projectionist. His brothers were projectionists in the movie. In the early movie business, they had the first Nickelodeon in Chicago, one of the first Nickelodeons. And they came from Italy in the early 1900s. And so my dad, after the war, came back and worked for Motorola. But on the weekends, he would get called in to be a projectionist. So here I am, 10 or 12 years old. It's what he did on the weekend, and I would go with him and watch film. So there's very few films I haven't seen. It's dating my age, but it was a very poor neighborhood. It was called the Royal Theater, and the adults were 25 cents, and the children were 10 cents, if you can believe that. And he was a very interesting man. He was doing what people did much later in New York. He would put together Humphrey Bogart films. There might be a film I'd see on TV, and I would go to the theater. He always had triple shows, three movies, and he changed them three times a week. Two or three times a week he changed them. You'd go see Humphrey Bogart, Treasure, Sierra Madre, John Huston, Maltese Falcon, yeah. And I would rewind the reels, and the balcony was condemned because it wasn't safe, but I cleaned off it was wood seats, very, you know, hard seat, and I cleaned them off, and my sister would come with me sometimes. I had two sisters and three brothers. I'm the one that ended up going to the movie house every weekend.
We talk about Electric Light in Blue a little bit. From today's point of view, this might look like a modern Western about quite topics that we are talking about today. Today we would say something like toxic masculinity, but it's really about men acting tough on the outside with all their guns and big talk, but they really suffer from loneliness and from fear of failure and from having very fragile egos. So in this regard, it's a very modern film, but it was very misunderstood at the time it came out.
Yeah, it wasn't received well. I had severe critics because it was too favorable to police. They didn't really understand the film, in my view, but I wanted to tell the story of a working man, every man that ends up in that position and just tries to do his best but and has dreams. And it was based on a true story. It was based on the first motorcycle cop killed in Arizona. And it wasn't like in the film, but he did get in the shootout. That's how I found somebody presented. Well, a friend of mine brought me the script. His name was Ken Silk, and he's an actor, very good guy. I've known him a long time. He's very close with Al Pacino. They're friends. He brought me. He said, "This is just a little cheap biker movie, but maybe you can do something with it." You know. So that's how I met That's how I heard about the property. And then because of my music career at that time, David Picker called me. I met with David Picker, who ran United Artists, and he said, "Boy, you know a lot about film. We talk film and everything." And he introduced me to quite a few people and said, "Listen, I'll give you $1 million, knock yourself out." And we made that movie for 900 and something.
And a lot of that money went to Conrad Hall because
I didn't get any money, yeah. My salary went to Connie. Connie was not going to shoot it. He was a much bigger cameraman and had a very high rate. He might have got $5,000-$10,000 a week, something like that. And we only had a budget for $2,000 or something. Connie was bringing cameramen in that he had trained or that he knew, you know, like Bill Fraker and Jordan Cronenworth was very high on Jordan. And we very much I wanted to get Jordan, but he was tied up and had a commitment. And then Connie said, "Listen, I know you don't have the money, but you'll find it somewhere. I'd like to do this. You know, I kind of think it'd be very interesting." So I gave Connie my salary, which was 100 or something like that. Yeah, it was good for him because we only shot 3 or 4 weeks.
But you got some fantastic footage because if you're filming in
No, Conrad was an artist. We had a huge disagreement and we came to terms on it. And he ribbed me every single day because I said, "I want color, contrast. And I want John Ford if we're doing an exterior. On the interiors, you'd knock yourself out. Tell me how you want to do it." It's very much more avant-garde on the interiors. Yeah, one of Ford's cameramen was Bill Clothier, and I remember every day he'd go when we finished something outside. He would go, "Bill Clothier, eat your heart out." You know, he ribbed me every day about shooting old-fashioned, you know. And I didn't realize it till I saw it. We built a lot of dolly tracks. There was no handheld. There might have been some handheld at the concert sequence there, but most of the stuff we shot, we built dolly tracks. Because I wanted to track. I wanted an older approach. And we shot it in Panavision, which took up quite a bit of my money, too. No, I didn't get any money for the movie. In fact, I think I said last night, were you there last night? Yeah. I had my per diem, that was it. But no, Conrad came up to my ranch, and I stayed in touch with Conrad. And I actually, John Schlesinger, not that he was a friend, but he called me. And I talked him into, he did two movies with John, Marathon Man and Day of the Locusts. And John was very grateful, and it worked out. He did a great job in Marathon. He did a good job in both of them, if you see him.
You're in line now with big pictures that were made in that area. I mean, it's like John Ford, Sergio Leone, or even Easy Rider. So it's like you're one up with the yes. greatest movies of those days. That's fantastic, and it's still fantastic to look at.
It took a lot of trust because the first week we got dailies, and then they didn't want to fly them up for me to see. So most of the I trusted him very much. And we any corrections we made was in post. So we did see some dailies, but not they cut it off. So I had to really trust Connie. And actually, a lot of the film is cut in the camera. I did long shots and tracking shots, and then a couple two-shot and close-up. And so we did a lot of because the film stock was very expensive. With the Panavision 2.3. So I trusted Conrad implicitly.
You also had a lot of trust in your actors, of course. You had a very young cast on the one hand, but also very some kind of veterans from the Western area.
Oh, yeah.
And of course you had Robert Blake. And to this day, a lot of people say this might be his best performance.
I think it was. And we didn't have a falling out, but after the film got so criticized for being a fascist film and too right-wing and too favorable to police, Robert went into UA and created a different campaign. He wanted to call it Chopper Copper, and we didn't. He didn't. Listen, when you're making a film, you have to deal with the personalities you have, but it's quite manipulative if they don't grasp your concept. So I understood his resentment, but I think I got a great performance out of him that I wanted, you know. He got a TV series out of it and was on had a hit series for many years called Beretta. And, yeah, you know, he had problems later in life. And actually, I was... Conrad called me, and we were going down to see Robert, who is not doing well in jail. And we canceled at the last minute because he finally got bail and was let out. Otherwise, I would have seen him.
At the end of this conversation, let's talk a little bit about the version we saw last night. So this movie is out now, of course, on Blu-ray, for example. Has there been some kind of restoration? Were you involved in the process of putting this movie out again in the recent years?
No, I wish I would have been. Yeah, I did the commentary, but it still isn't as sharp or as colorful as I remember everything. Because I had a really good screening room, and I did everything up at my ranch. I edited it. Took me, I pretty much put it all together up there without any influence of anybody.
Thanks so much for taking your time here before you go back to the States to talk to us about this fantastic movie. Thank you.
Oh, no, thank you. I appreciate being here. It's a beautiful country and wonderful people.